This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. If you thought Monday night's NCAA men's championship game was slow, listen to this.
Now let's watch as they move the ball around until Big Jim Neal gets positioned on Mikan.
That sound from the 1954 NBA Finals. In the film, the players look as if they're moving in slow motion.
Finally, Mickelson, the third man, grabs the ball and it's a field goal for Minneapolis.
A few months after that game, the 24-second clock would be adopted by the NBA. Some say it saved the league. Eventually, the idea of a shot clock went to college, too. Our story begins with that clock and the man everyone believed was behind it. Only a Game's Karen Given has that story.
Danny Biazone was 83 years old on the day in 1992 when Sean Kirst, then a columnist for the Syracuse Post-Standard, came to visit him.
Danny was this tiny, indomitable force. When I met him, he was 2 weeks before death. He was in his bowling alley, which had remained unchanged since the days when he owned the Nats.
Biazone owned the Syracuse Nationals from 1946 to 1963, and he owned that bowling alley back then, too. The story Kirst had heard, the story everyone had heard, was that after a game one night, Danny Biazone scribbled calculations on the back of a napkin at the bar of his bowling alley and invented the 24-second clock. Kirst says Biazone never talked about the clock. He always called it the time.
He said that the game had become tedious and no one wanted to watch it because if one team got up by 10 points, they'd just stall the ball for the rest of the game. Danny said something had to change. You had to have a change in the time. So he never said, I came up with this idea.
Biazone didn't have to say he came up with the idea. Legendary Celtics executive Red Auerbach said it for him. Danny Biazone invented the 24-second clock by himself alone, Kirst quoted Auerbach as saying. I was at the meeting when he introduced it. He should get all the credit in the world for it.
So I wrote about that, and I get a call out of the blue from a woman who is very upset, who says to me, my husband was instrumental in creating the clock, and no one remembers him and no one believes it. And she was so upset, I wondered if it was for real. Some of my colleagues said that she had called before, and people sort of, to put this harshly, people kind of wrote her off as a crackpot.
Ever since he was a kid, Kirst had studied early basketball history, so the woman's claims got his attention.
I said, okay, Mrs. Ferris, I'll come out and talk to you. So I go out to this house in North Syracuse where this really gracious, wonderful person greets me. Tells me that her husband is dying of Huntington's and can't speak for himself.
Leo Ferris had a fatal genetic disorder. Some have said it's like dying of Alzheimer's, ALS, and Parkinson's all at the same time.
She brings out a paper bag and says, here's the clippings. And it's a paper grocery bag. And I start going through it, and in maybe a quarter of the way through, I pull out a newspaper that shows Leo Ferris with Ned Irish and these other giants of basketball in 1949 at the instant at which the NBA was created. It blew my doors off. It was like, holy smokes. And I had no clue. I apologized. I apologized on behalf of myself, and I apologized on behalf of all of the basketball hierarchy that had forgotten her husband and had disregarded her. I said, you know, you're right, and we're going to do something about this. And this thing really became more than just journalism to me. It became a quest for justice, historic justice for this remarkable family that had been totally overlooked unfairly.
Around the same time, nearly 2,000 miles away, Christian Figueroa was growing up in Puerto Rico. Like many of his friends, he loved playing and watching basketball. One day, before he was 10 years old,
I was watching a basketball game. TV. It was definitely involving Michael Jordan and the Bulls. And my mother turned the corner and she started to watch the game with me. And she said, oh, do you know my Uncle Leo invented the shot clock? And I was like, what? Really? You never told me that.
Figueroa knew that his mother had been raised in upstate New York, but this was the first time she had mentioned her Uncle Leo, who was, of course, Leo Ferris. From then on, whenever she would catch her son watching an NBA game on TV, she'd share another story of her uncle and his connections with the league.
And, you know, I'd go to school and I'd say, hey, well, my great uncle invented the 24-second shot clock. And they'd turn around, my friends, and say, yeah, well, my grandmother invented the three-point line. And they just wouldn't believe me. And so I remember at an early age being frustrated by my lack of proof.
During the summers, Figueroa visited his mother's family in upstate New York, and that's where he met his Aunt Beverly, Leo's wife. She'd come to family reunions and bring an envelope filled with old photos and newspaper clippings. Figueroa hung on her every word. It must have been a relief for Beverly Ferris to find such a receptive audience. Leo was growing weaker by the day. Along with her daughter Jamie, Beverly provided all of Leo's care at home. And she still hadn't found anyone other than journalist Sean Kirst, who believed her.
She fought many years, even when he was still alive, even when her daughter was getting sick. She fought and fought to get the truth out. I can't even imagine how difficult that must have been for her.
Decades later, Christian Figueroa would pick up where his great aunt left off. Meanwhile, Sean Kirst was digging into the stories Beverly Ferris had told him, finding corroboration the best way he knew how.
Sitting with a lever at a microfilm machine in the back room of a library and reading clips and just going day by day and reading the things, because in the old days they reported everything.
Kirst says if not for Leo Ferris, the NBA as we know it might never have been formed. Back in the 1940s, there were two rival pro basketball leagues, the larger, more established BAA, and the smaller upstart, the NBL. Ferris was the co-founder and GM of an NBL team, the Buffalo, later Tri-State Bisons. Ferris and the other NBL executives knew their league couldn't survive if it had to compete with the BAA, so...
So they make him president of the NBL with the mission to be force a merger with the BAA.
Leo Ferris did what upstart league presidents do. He outbid the BAA for the best players coming out of college. But then he came up with a crazy idea. Why settle for signing one college player at a time when he could sign a whole college team?
Kentucky had a team that they called the Fabulous Five, and he creates a franchise for them. He says, if you guys come to our league, you can have the Indianapolis franchise. It'll be your team. That is the move that broke the BAA's back. They say, okay, that's enough.
That old black and white photo Beverly Ferris showed Sean Kirst on that afternoon back in 1992 was taken on August 3rd, 1949, the day the two leagues merged to form the NBA. Five men stand smiling, their hands stacked on top of each other. Ferris is in the middle. His left hand rests on the top of the pile.
So you can argue that if a meteor had fell on Leo at that moment, he should be in basketball's Hall of Fame. But he doesn't stop there. That's what's so cool.
Sean Kirst had gotten at least one thing absolutely right in his story about Syracuse Nats owner/bowling alley operator Danny Biasone.
Danny said something had to change. You had to have a change in the time.
The idea of a shot clock was already out there, but how much time should be on it? Leo Ferris did the math. By 1954, he was the general manager of Biasone's team. Looking over box scores from games that had been hard-fought and exciting, he and Biasone counted an average of 120 shots, roughly 60 by each team. It was Leo Ferris who took pen to napkin at the bowling alley bar. The game is 48 minutes long. 48 minutes equals 2,880 seconds. Divide that by 120 and you've got the 24-second shot clock. Leo Ferris, not Danny Biasone, presented the clock to the rules committee meeting. All of this is documented in old newspaper clippings.
Just to give you the importance of this thing, Bill Himmelman, the NBA historian for many years, once said, there are two moments of importance in basketball history. There's the moment when Dr. Naismith nails a peach basket to the wall, and there's the moment when they turn on the 24-second clock.
Leo's role in all of this, the shot clock, the formation of the NBA, and more, was thoroughly reported in the Post Standard and other newspapers of the day. So why, when Beverly Ferris called the sports desk 40 years later, did no one believe her story?
He did all this before he was even 39 years old. He left the game at 38 years old.
That was just months after the shot clock was introduced. Christian Figueroa says it would take decades before anyone realized the importance of the things Leo Farris had done.
By then, he was sick, and by then, he was decades out of the game, and by then, history had been rewritten, frankly.
Leo Farris died in 1993 after a 25-year battle with Huntington's disease. Beverly Farris died in 2010 without seeing her husband recognized for his achievements. Leo and Beverly's daughter Jamie also inherited Huntington's. Figueroa visited her before her death in 2014.
And even as all her muscle functions were deteriorating, she still would talk about him. She would come alive when she got to talk about Leo. When she passed in 2014, it got me thinking about another family member passed, another family member who knew Leo, another family member that had fought for Leo.
Not every family would have fought so hard. Some might have felt that Leo's post-NBA career in real estate was enough evidence of a life well lived. But for Beverly and Jamie, recognition was everything. By the time his cousin died, Christian Figueroa had a son of his own, a son who loved basketball. And Figueroa decided it was his turn to pick up the fight to set straight his family's legacy.
So this is for Leo, for Aunt Beverly, this is for cousin Jamie, and for all the people who suffer and have suffered from Huntington's disease.
Christian Figueroa's efforts have paid off. For the past 2 years, Leo Farris has been nominated for the Naismith Hall of Fame. It's a start, but just last weekend, the Hall announced its 2017 inductees. Once again, Leo Farris was not on the list. But Sean Kirst believes it's just a matter of time.
How could any fair person hearing our conversation here today, how could you say, you know, that he doesn't belong in there? That this thing is happening, that a great nephew in Boston embraces the cause of this forgotten upstate basketball pioneer. It's just a joyous story, and I hope it has a joyous culmination.
Me too. How could I not? For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
You're listening to Only a Game from NPR. I'd like to thank Zippered Up for this review on iTunes. I started listening to Only a Game on NPR as a gymnastics coach driving to meets on Saturday mornings. Now in retirement, I choose to sleep in but listen to the podcast while making believe I'm doing things around the house and the yard. Loved it then, even more now. Thank you, Zippered Up. Now get back to work. Consider visiting iTunes and leaving a review of your own. It really does help other listeners to find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know.
William on the drive. Pull up, pull up. Got it! She got it! She got it!
And that is the sound of a 111-game winning streak coming to an end. Mississippi State's victory over UConn in the women's Final Four is where we're going to start this week. My guests are Bleacher Report's Eric Malinowski and Sports on Earth's Will Leach, both via Skype. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks, Bill.
Hello.
Eric, you're on first.
As we said, Morgan Williams with the shot up, and long live UConn women's basketball. As you said before, they won 111 straight games. 108 of those were by double digits. It was 867 days in between losses. This was an incredible achievement that we should soak in and we should appreciate for all of its merits. I love that it ended on a very round number. I'm going to be able to remember 111 forever. 112 would have required a little bit more synapses firing, so I appreciate them doing that just for me. But on the other hand, I wonder, as good as this winning streak obviously was for the popularity of women's basketball, I'm curious, was this sort of the perfect time for this to end? Like, I feel like there was a part of me that this morbid curiosity is going to reach 200 wins, 250. What other round number can they hit? But at the same time, you know, we always talk about the virtues of parity and competition and things like that. And It was so unbelievably dramatic. I was covering a Warriors game in Oakland, and along press row, we all had our laptops open, streaming to ESPN, watching to see how this incredible game was going to end. So I feel like either way, it probably ended at the right time. But on the other hand, I wonder how far could they have possibly taken it?
First of all, I'd like to note, by the way, what Eric talks about is totally true and always worth keeping in mind in sports coverage. People covering the game are always watching a more interesting game on their laptops while the game is covering. That's absolutely true. Secondly, yeah, to me, the best part about this ending is that it ended on the biggest stage possible. If this would have been like a tight game against Syracuse in mid-December, I don't think anyone would have cared. It would have been noted like, oh, that's interesting. Oh, well, I had to end sometime. As for the idea of like how we'll remember this, frankly, it's Connecticut. They may do this again. For me, that is one of the great things about Connecticut and great things about any sort of favorite like that. They are polarizing. Like Gino Auriemma is a controversial figure for a lot of people. He actually had some quotes even in the last week where he talked about, I'm not sure women want to coach, that was to the point that his daughter actually went on Twitter and said, ugh, dad, stop it. And, you know, nobody else in women's college basketball has that kind of megaphone. You know, we always talk about how we want parity and we want everything to be fair, everyone to be equal. But what we really want are heroes and villains.
Well, Will, I really like one point that you made, and that is the idea of a daughter going on Twitter to say to her dad, hey, dad, stop it.
Yes.
I wish that would happen in at least one other context. But I think the thing that we have to keep in mind is that all this talk about Connecticut and what they've done and what they might do next notwithstanding, credit needs to be given to the players on Mississippi State for beating Connecticut and then to the players on South Carolina's team for beating Mississippi State. Those were terrific wins for each of those two teams. And hey, here we are talking about women's basketball. So the whole constellation of events was obviously very good for the game.
Yeah, I completely agree. I feel like we need to remember the name of Morgan William. You know, I mean, give her all the ESPYs, give her an Emmy, you know, give her anything that she qualifies for. But we need to remember the name of Morgan William forever. And the more we discuss it, I think the more we can appreciate it over time.
All right, Will, it's your turn.
Well, one of my common arguments is that if you are a consumer of sports or a sports fan, this is, in fact, the best time to do that. You can watch any game that you want at any point from any of your devices. You have every statistic you might want. I can yell at a player on Twitter and he can call me an idiot back. It's amazing the connection that we have. There's one thing, however, where it's so much worse, and that is in college sports recruiting. My beloved Illinois Fighting Illini just hired their new coach, Brad Underwood, and their big recruit, a kid named Jeremiah Tillman. Tillman had committed to Illinois, had not committed to Illinois, had committed to Illinois, and this week announced he was not going to Illinois. Now, in any sane society, what a 17-year-old does about going to college or not going to this college or going to this college, am I going to go here, am I going to go here, we would not only not care, it would be actively bizarre and terrifying to care. Instead, he's getting yelled at by Illini fans. He's getting begged to come by fans of other teams. You know, my father is a big Illinois basketball fan like I am, but he never pays attention to this. He never has any idea who recruiting is. He just watches the first game of the season and, hey, there's new guys on my team now. Let's check these guys out. That is how we should all watch sports. We will all be such happier people if we pay no attention to recruiting, if we leave these kids alone and just wake up the first day of the season and say, hey, awesome, look who's on my team now, go new guy on my team.
Eric, are you on board with this, the idea that we should pay no attention to recruiting unless we are salaried assistant coaches?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this is sort of the ridiculous everyday underbelly of college sports that, like, it just really doesn't even deserve our attention, really. There's just so much more that we can get upset and outraged about. You know, this one can definitely be sort of kept down the bottom of the ladder.
It is a challenge to make fun of only one facet of the machinery of college basketball. And there's always a risk that once you start pulling on that single thread, everything connected with this absurd spectacle will unravel, which would be okay with me. Actually, we could rebuild a better one, I bet. But, Will, I do take your point. Now, what would you have the powers that B do about it? Is there any way to discourage people going so nuts about recruiting?
Well, the worst part about this, of course, is once you've opened up the box, you can't shut it. If you ask me what I want the powers to be to do, I want them to put Jeremiah Tillman back on Illinois. Like, that's the worst part about this, is I'm as bad as everybody else. Because once you start paying attention, you just can't help but look at it. And the one thing I would say, though, this is without question true. There is nothing worse, and really not much sadder, than like a middle-aged guy going on Twitter and saying, oh, yeah, you betrayed us, 17-year-old who didn't actually come to the school and has no connection and will not be paid if he does go there.
There's a million reasons to not tweet, and that one is tied with all of them.
All right, we're going to put basketball in the rearview mirror and turn to hockey because the NHL has announced that they're not going to send their players to the Olympics in 2018. This is, of course, because the team owners don't want to build a hiatus into their season every 4 years. It's a bad decision. Players who like to compete for their countries are going to be disappointed. Fans who would rather see the best players at the Olympics, they'll be disappointed. The NHL, of course, is also missing an opportunity to publicize its sport, which is in great need of publicizing. The owners have presented themselves by doing this as greedy and inflexible. It's bad public relations as well. Olympic hockey before the pros ever went would sometimes give us a heck of a show. I give you, for example, 1980, when the U.S. played Russia in not the finals, remember, but the semis. But now, I hate the metaphor about you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube, but that's sort of where we are on this. The NHL has been there. How can they say, no, we're not going to go there anymore? I think it's a bad decision. Anybody want to take the other side on that?
I don't know if I would take the other side, but I remember I was in Sochi in 2014, and there was like a press conference with the head of the IOC and Gary Bettman, the NHL commissioner, were having this discussion about having players there. And the head of the IOC said, well, you know, for most of these players, obviously winning a gold medal is one of the best things they can ever do. And Gary Bettman interrupted, actually, it's the Stanley Cup. The Stanley Cup is the best thing they can ever do. And first off, it was strange because I felt like sympathy and on the side of someone that works for the International Olympic Committee, which is not a position I recommend anyone ever
be on.
I know it's a terrible place, but to me, that is a large part of this. Like, there is still a sense from the NHL that the players are ours. To me, the best example of how much a mistake this is frankly, the World Cup of Soccer. Like, there's nothing gets people more excited, particularly about here in the United States, about the MLS than the World Cup. Sure, it messes up the season in the Premier League. It messes up a lot of seasons, but it's so worth it. So for them to not be able to see the forest for the trees from that, what they're really doing is saying, we think this is more important to these players than the Olympics, and players tend to not like having that told to them.
I'm a little bit torn on this because, you know, as an alum of Boston University, you brought up 1980. It is ingrained into my DNA to want to root for, you know, high level, you know, collegiate players in the Olympics and kind of see what they can do. On the other hand, I think back to like the 2010, you know, Olympic hockey final. I have like I couldn't be in front of a television, but I have very visceral memories of trying to find a radio feed, you know, somewhere and just trying to hear whatever updates I could. And I just think that if we didn't have professional players in there, I just don't think that that sort of level of interest would spread out the way it does. So this is what people, the modern hockey fans, especially international hockey fans, have come to expect. And I think it raises the whole level of the game and it makes for a better product ultimately.
I think you've made my argument very well. And I hope that Gary Bettman is listening. That's all I can say. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Bleacher Report's Eric Malinowski and Sports on Earth's Will Leach. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Bill.
A pleasure.
These days, the Chicago Cubs are a feel-good story, but I'm told it's necessary or at least advisable to provide an advisory note before I launch into this particular Cubs story because there are some words in it, even though they're bleeped, that some listeners may find offensive. Until August 8, 1988, the Chicago Cubs played all their home games in daylight. That meant that on a spring afternoon when children came home from school on the elevated train that ran by Wrigley Field,
very often the W or L flag would be raised right in front of the L platform as we passed the Addison Street Station so we could see if the Cubs won or lost. And of course, I don't have to say, usually it was the L flag.
Scott Simon, the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday, began paying attention to those flags and the Cubs as a child. He didn't have much choice.
My godfather was Jack Brickhouse, who was the Chicago Cubs announcer for many years. He was the guy who actually preceded Harry Carey. And his home run chant, still very famous in Chicago, back, back, that's it,
Hey!
Oh, beat the left. Back! That's it! Hey!
He taught me that if you were going to be a Cubs fan, you had to accept their history. You couldn't count on them winning. You couldn't even count on them improving. But what you could count on was the fact that you would have a great day at the park.
Out of necessity, that became the marketing campaign for the Cubs. Come on out to this beautiful ballpark, enjoy a hot dog and a cold beer in the sunshine. And for decades, each new stadium built by a ball club somewhere else made Wrigley Field seem more charming, no matter the quality of the home team.
People would go to Wrigley Field and they would be, you know, almost oblivious to what the score on the field was. They'd turn around and go, oh, I guess we're behind again. But that didn't mean they wouldn't get 3 million people into the park every year.
Well, maybe not quite 3 million, but that camaraderie and incidental baseball defined the experience of the Cubs fan. And everybody was happy with that, right? You could argue that until the afternoon of April 29th, 1983. As the day dawned, there was no reason to anticipate that change was imminent at Wrigley. Certainly, there was nothing different about the home team.
Oh, they were terrible. They had begun the season, they lost 14 games, and they'd won only five. And the day in which you're speaking, they had lost to the Los Angeles Dodgers 4-3. You know, close game as these things go. And as the team was walking in from the field, Lee Elia, their manager, heard boos from the stands. So by the time that he actually reached the locker room, he was on full boil.
They're really, really behind you around here. My ass.
Those are the fans. These are us. He's talking about their bill.
The don't even work. That's why they're out at the game. 85% of the world's working. The other 15 come out here.
Was Lee Elia the sort of manager inclined to speak that way?
Well, I, you know, like a lot of managers, he spoke baseball. He actually just used, you know, one profanity over and over again. It's not like he had a whole host.
Lots of managers lose their tempers and unleash lots of epithets, or the same epithet over and over, whatever. But Elia's outrage wouldn't have made sense anywhere but in Wrigley Field. It was the only major league park where you could only see a game while everybody with a job was at work. And Elia's characterization of people watching from the stands as unemployable nabobs and ne'er-do-wells, well, you have to wonder, don't you, if there was any excuse for it.
What you see when you kind of read between the lines is that he was being very loyal to his players. He was defending them from what he thought were the nudnik fans who were booing them.
The Cubs arranged a radio interview where Elia would apologize.
Uncle Jack was still the team announcer then. Lelia made a full apology and said, I don't know what got into me. I'm really sorry. We have the greatest fans in the world here in Chicago, and I can't believe that I insulted them. And he and Uncle Jack went out for a drink afterwards. And Uncle Jack said that he just looked across at him and said, forgive me, what the were you thinking? And I don't know what got into me. And he was let go as manager of the Cubs within a few weeks.
So Lee Elia was gone, but not forgotten. He'd added a grand story to the legend of the Cubs. His tirade was the sort of event that causes people of a certain sort to remember where they were when they heard it and how they reacted.
I couldn't stop laughing. There was just something so fundamentally charming about it. I wasn't outraged. I didn't feel that as a fan I had been affronted. And the fact that it was so outrageous underscored the fact that there's something about this franchise that just wasn't the same like other franchises.
For most fans, the broadcast apology was the end of that particular Cubs story, but not for Scott Simon. After Lee Elia left the bar and went home on the night of that fateful outburst, Simon got the debrief from his customary source.
So Uncle Jack and I talked at about 10:30. 10:45. And I remember I said to him something like, do you think fans are going to show up at the ballpark? And he said, are you kidding? I think fans are going to be moved to show up more than ever.
The Cubs drew 1.5 million fans in 83 and 500,000 more than that the following season. And throughout the 80s and the 90s and into the 21st century, the Cubs continued to be the Cubs. That is, they continued to avoid the World Series, perhaps concerned that if they got there, they might win. And that would change everything, because you cannot be a lovable loser if you win. And then last summer and fall, the Cubs turned their back on the hard-earned image based on curses, errors, bad trades, bad luck, and, of course, Lee Elia's peppery attack on the paying customers.
The Cubs win the World Series!
They won, and it changed everything for their fans, right? It had to, at least for one public radio host who'd always counted on the Cubs when he'd made autumn fundraising appearances at NPR affiliates.
And I would begin by saying, you know, I'm kind of astonished to see that here we are in October and they're still playing baseball. Did you know that? As a Cubs fan, I thought that, you know, I thought the season ended in September. I can't use that material anymore now, can I?
No, absolutely not.
I can no longer say I don't follow professional sports. I'm a Cubs fan.
Right. That material doesn't work anymore. But what Cubs fan mourns the loss? Not Scott Simon.
The whole idea that the Chicago Cubs had won the World Series, not only is it a notion that had really never occurred to me for most of my life, not in my father's life, who is now gone, not in my grandfather's life. This was just not an event that I ever thought that I would see.
The event was momentous enough to provoke Scott Simon to write his eighth book. It's titled My Cubs, A Love Story. Daniele and Fede are cousins, and they don't have much in common.
My name is Daniele Molmenti. I'm a full Italian stallion.
Daniele is the sportsman. Daniele is the successful. I am the one who is good at math.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. Hi, it's Bill Littlefield. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to ask you about you. That's right. At Only a Game, we want to learn more about our listeners with a short survey. It's anonymous, it's easy, and it'll take less than 10 minutes to complete. Just go to wbur.podcastingsurvey.com to complete the survey right now. That's wbur.podcastingsurvey.com. This survey will be tremendously helpful to us, so thank you. I'm Bill Littlefield. Next week on Only a Game, we will mark the 70th anniversary of the breaking of Major League Baseball's color barrier. But right now, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Since we last spoke, college basketball has crowned two champions. One of them is South Carolina. Their women's team beat Mississippi State on Sunday night.
Wait a minute. Hold on.
I know.
There's something wrong with this story.
I'm trying to move past UConn's loss in the semifinals. Let's talk about the winners. What do you think? Is the entire women's game revitalized because it has a first-time champion in South Carolina?
Well, I don't know, but it certainly is the biggest surprise of the last three or four sports years, I'd say. I think Dawn Staley's a terrific advertisement for basketball in general and women's basketball in particular. She's just terrific. She's going to be a great Olympic coach, and I was very happy for her. I mean, I was also astounded at what happened.
For the winner on the men's side, we move one state up on the map, North Carolina, no stranger to the Final Four. This time, they prevailed in a contest some have called ugly. Are they right?
No, definitely. It was the worst championship game I think I've ever seen. The officials were completely in violation of my friend Bob Ryan's first rule of officiating, which is know why you're on the floor. They did not know why they were on the floor, okay? They thought they were on the floor to be the show. It was awful. Mm. Just dreadful. Nobody could shoot. It was another example of why basketball should not be played in football domes. Everything went wrong. If I were Gonzaga, I would leave my first Final Four with a very sour taste in my mouth.
By winning, North Carolina's players earned themselves championship T-shirts and caps, and they earned their coach, Roy Williams, a $925,000 bonus. Maybe he'll take everybody out to dinner.
I don't think he's allowed to be perfectly frank with you.
Well, they're there now. I mean... He's not recruiting them.
Oh, no. Lack of institutional control. Of course, this all takes place in the middle of the University of North Carolina being amid a massive academic fraud scandal. Yes, Roy Williams gets almost $1 million, and the players, if they get anything, get pilloried in the press.
Wednesday night's game between the Boston Celtics and the Cleveland Cavaliers was promoted as a potential changing of the guard, Charlie, but Cleveland was apparently not ready to step out of the way. They romped 114-91. Does this mean anything going forward?
It means, number one, that LeBron James is awake and ready for the playoffs, and that the let's rest the stars period of the NBA season is over. I think the Celtics are better than they played the other night. I don't know that it will mean anything going forward in the playoffs, but it does mean that the Cleveland Cavaliers are very much ready to defend their title.
Having served one of the longer apprenticeships, 15 years as an assistant coach, Patrick Ewing was named head coach of the men's basketball team at Georgetown this week. He certainly has some experience with Georgetown. Do you like his chances to succeed?
I think Patrick will be fine. I think it's a great advertisement for the Big East to have Chris Mullin at St. John's and Patrick Ewing at Georgetown. I just wish the late Pearl Washington had survived long enough to coach at Syracuse. I'm a little bit surprised by this, to be perfectly honest with you. I thought after having fired John Thompson III, the son, of course, of the man who coached Patrick Ewing in the Georgetown's glory days, I thought that Georgetown would make a complete break with the Thompson era. Apparently, that's just not possible for them. But I'm very happy for Patrick. I remember the days when he was in high school and people were showing up in gorilla suits and throwing bananas at him and stuff. So anything that nice that happens to Patrick Ewing in his life is fine by me.
First, it was the U.S. women's hockey team. This week, it was the U.S. women's soccer team that got itself a better deal from their federation. More money, better benefits, etc. It's enough to make a fellow feel that solidarity isn't quite dead.
No, it's been really terrific. The ripple effects of what the U.S. women's hockey team did are really considerable at this point, and they have, I think, empowered women athletes in other sports to look around and say, hey, what about us, too? And if there's anything more basically American than that, I don't know what it is.
It should be noted that progress, notwithstanding, the women are still not being paid as well as the men are in their sports.
No, and that's a shame, and we're moving toward it, and we're not moving toward it fast enough.
Charlie, baseball is not supposed to be a contact sport. I guess nobody better try telling that to Stephen Piscotty of the St. Louis Cardinals. On Tuesday, he was hit by a pitch on the right elbow, which put him on base. Then while he was running the bases, he was hit by a thrown ball on the other elbow. And then heading home, he got hit in the head by another throw. Tough inning.
This is unbelievable to me. I have a question, though. Obviously, it's a big moment in baseball history, right? What will they ask Stephen Piscotty to send to the Hall of Fame to commemorate this?
Yeah, x-rays, I guess.
X-rays or bandages or, you know, cold packs or what?
Tony Romo, late the quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys, is leaving football. Actually, he's not leaving football. He's just moving upstairs to watch games and talk about them rather than play in them. CBS has hired him. Fox and NBC were apparently both interested. Sounds as if he was a highly coveted media free agent.
Yes. I mean, it was always thought that once he got tired of having his shoulder separated every year, he would be a terrific analyst. He's being moved right into the number one analyst slot at CBS, replacing Phil Simms, which is a real jump. So we'll see.
Finally, Charlie, we have heard so many stories about how Olympic venues fall into disrepair after the Olympic Games. Nobody uses them, but hundreds of athletes have made sure that that's not happening in Sochi. They're skiers, and they're only half-dressed, and the point is they've gathered in larger numbers than ever. You want to yell sports now?
No, I'm letting this one go. Are you kidding? This is very definitely sports of the quieter variety. Look at these videos. It's wonderful. People are not wearing clothes, and they're falling in the snow.
Uh-huh.
This is a great thing.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Here in the Northeast, we've reached the time of year when I start looking at the bicycle that's been gathering dust in my garage all winter and thinking, is it warm enough yet? Please let it be warm enough, because outdoor exercise is so much more fun. But if not for the gym, we wouldn't have this next story from commentator Alyssa Eli.
Social trends find their way to the gym, whether we want them to or not. I was on the Stairmaster with a gossip magazine, looking forward to learning the details of a recent celebrity divorce, the usual half hour of climbing steps while going nowhere. That's the crazy nature of machines that stay in place. A stylish young college student, black leggings under silver basketball shorts, matching bandana, mounted the adjacent machine. He had his iPad with him, and I figured he was also planning to read. He pushed buttons, slid screens right and left, settled himself, and turned to me. "Excuse me," he said, "and good morning. I'm about to watch a movie I've never seen before. There may be some disturbing scenes in it, and I would like to apologize for them in advance." This was unusual. "I'm not certain how they might be disturbing," he said, hitting the power on the Stairmaster, "because I don't know what happens. But if they are disturbing, I'd like to say that it's not deliberate and I apologize again." "No problem," I said. "You go right ahead." He told me the name of the movie. I recognized the title and had in fact read a bit about its star in my magazine. His Life is Excellent, Hollywood Food. I hadn't seen the film but didn't expect to be offended. This was a Stairmaster, not a college assignment that could cause secondhand trauma. My plan was to learn about celebrities while burning a couple of hundred calories. The efficient use of gym time always brings both literary and aerobic satisfaction. "Well, here we go," he said, starting to speed up, already huffing, leaning low on the side rails. "Looking forward to this." "Enjoy," I said. "God bless you," he answered politely, putting in his earbuds. We live in times of social consciousness, filled with wrong step worries. He really wanted to watch a movie. I really wanted to read. What we both wanted was to work out. Sometimes a person just needs relief.
Alyssa Eli is a psychiatrist living in Boston. Athletes aren't supposed to bet on their own performances. That's the kind of thing that can get you banned from a Hall of Fame. Or it can get you a vineyard. Here's only a game's Martin Kessler to explain.
This story isn't really about sports. It's about family and wine, specifically Prosecco. The main characters are two cousins.
My full name is Federico, okay? But it's too long, so they call me Fede.
My name is Daniele Molmenti, and I'm a full Italian stallion.
Fede and Daniele are from the northeastern part of Italy, up near the Alps where the grapes for Prosecco are grown. As kids, the cousins couldn't have been much more different from each other. By the time he was 20, Daniele, that's the Italian stallion, was a world-class kayaker. Fede was not.
If Daniele is a role model for sports, I am a role model as well, but as an anti-role model.
What was it like for you to have this amazingly athletic cousin?
I just ignored him. It was the only way. Now, you know, Daniele is the handsome, Daniele is the sportsman, Daniele is the successful. I am the one, who is good at math. So that's the only thing I can say.
Fede moved to London, worked as an engineer. Daniele went to the Olympics. In 2008, in Beijing, Daniele reached the final in the kayak slalom, finished 10th, thought he should have done better. So he started training for the 2012 London Games, spent the winters in Nottingham in the UK. He cut out junk food, cut out alcohol. Daniele was focused, at least most of the time. See, Fede was still living just a couple hours away in London, and on weekends, Fede tried to put his cousin through an alternative training program. It consisted of trips to tantalizing London food markets.
I think at the time, Daniele did find some time to actually drink a little bit of a glass and maybe some food that you wouldn't recommend it as part of the healthy diet. But Daniele, maybe you were on a break.
Daniele says a day with his cousin canceled out 4 days of training. But despite Fede's concerted effort to slow down his cousin, Daniele managed to win golds at the 2010 World Championships and 2011 European Championships. Leading up to the 2012 Olympics, Fede could tell his cousin was ready.
And I have to say, now I'm not joking, the look in his eyes will tell you everything. It was clear they was going for all or nothing.
So you knew he was going to do it?
Yeah, frankly. However, not enough, because otherwise I would never have accepted the bet.
Yes, the bet. About a month before the start of the games, Fede and Daniele were out in central London for one of Fede's alternative training days. this particular session was being held near Borough Market.
Absolutely. Out of the blue, he said to me, "Say, Feather, if I'm going to win, and I quote, the gold medal at the Olympic, yeah, not a medal. If I'm going to win the gold medal at the Olympic, I think we should buy something that reminds us about our land and, you know, clearly a vineyard."
In case you didn't catch that, Daniele suggested they buy a vineyard in Italy to remind them of where they grew up.
Which I thought it was a very nice thing to say. But frankly, what do you say? The gold medal, let's say, yeah, yeah, whatever, Daniele. Yes, of course, we're going to do it. Yeah.
The terms of the bet were set. If Daniele won gold, the cousins would buy a vineyard together. And if he didn't, Daniele would buy Fede a beer. A beer. Not even a glass of wine.
Basically, I was the loser either way. I didn't work out the odds very well.
Unlike Fede, Daniele had been working out the odds. He knew he had a good shot at winning gold and the Italian Olympic Committee's 140,000 euro prize that would come with it. And the thought of buying a vineyard had been bubbling up for a while.
When I win some race, I always spend the money drinking wine. So if I produce my own wine, I can save lots of money.
Can't fault that logic. So the Olympics began, and Daniele once again reached the finals of the kayak slalom. Fede watched from the bleachers. He was nervous. Daniele? Relaxed. Minutes before his own run, Daniele watched one of his top rivals.
This is good by Radulek. The Czech Republic are going to be sitting pretty on top of the table after this one. 94-78.
And I was next to my coach, and I remember my coach was looking at me like very worried. And I say to my coach, like, I was sorry for him because, like, you're not thinking I can be faster. So I say to him, well, I do half of a second faster.
And sure enough.
What has Malmenti done? Oh, it's a massive improvement. 93.43.
Daniele wasn't a half second faster. He was a second and a half faster. No one came close to his time. Daniele, still in his kayak, splashed around, shouting in celebration. You probably won't be shocked to hear that Fede had a very different reaction.
I start to cry by the emotion a little bit, and everyone thinks that it was just the joy. Yeah, it definitely was the joy, but actually sudden realization that I had to find the money to honor the bet, and that definitely made me cry quite a lot.
A couple of days after the competition, after spending time with his cousin, Fede started to regain some hope.
We had dinner, we had a couple of drinks, and, you know, no mention whatsoever. And clearly, I thought that he had forgotten about it. And then, just before he went to bed, he said to me, Fede, you remember about the bet, right? So we're going to buy the vineyard, right? So when I go back to Italy, I'm going to go and start to look around, okay? Anyway, it's late now. Good night. That was it.
Daniele returned to Italy and found a plot of land in the northeast. The cousins pooled their money, and with the addition of a hefty loan, they bought it. They call it the Golden Vineyard. It's a fitting title. Daniele ended up putting his winnings from the Olympics and other competitions into the land. In 2014, the first bottle of Molmenti Chilat Prosecco was sold. Daniele's athletic career is now over. He coaches the Italian national team and works a couple days a week in the vineyard. Meanwhile, Fede works on the financial side of the operation from London, where he still has his day job. He says it'll be years before the loan is paid off. But the guy who cried when he realized he'd have to honor the bet now says he's in it for the long haul.
It is a hard work, but you know, I'm doing with Daniele, and that makes the difference, and we are having a lot of fun. I'm really pleased that he made that bet with me, and I'm so pleased I lost it.
Still, Fede has made a resolution. He's never, ever going to make another bet with his cousin. For Only a Game, I'm Martin Kessler.
We first learned about Fede and Daniele at Vice's food website, Munchies. You can link to the story at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our intern is Ryan Fitzgerald. Our final word this week comes from cousins Daniele and Fede, who want you to know that their wine is not yet for sale in the U.S.
If you know any importer in U.S., now you know my Skype, my email.
Yeah, but Martin, please make sure that you talk to the finance director first, which is me. So, all right, okay, so let's go.
Yeah, Martin, leave the finance director out of the loop at your peril. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game, and thanks for listening.
Support for Only a Game comes from the May Family Foundation, supporting college reentry, a practical semester-long program in New York City, helping young adults with mental health challenges make a successful return to college. More at collegereentry.org. And the Lummelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and in developing countries, and working to inspire and enable the next generation of inventors. More information is available at lummelson.org.